Okay, Parshas Noach. Noach is a fascinating character, and it's a little hard to appreciate the attitude that Chazal have towards Noach. Noach has probably the most complicated PR of any biblical character, or at least anybody in Chumash. That on the one hand, he has, if you look just at the Torah Shebichtav, he has the best PR, and I'm mentioning this as an introduction to the parsha overall, but also because it has particular relevance to Sheni, to our Aliyah, at the same time as it's relevant to the whole parsha. So the parsha begins with these wonderful statements, L'chora, about Noach, Noach ish tzaddik, tamim hayu b'dorotav, and there are relevant psukim in this Aliyah also, that are a part of the very mixed picture that gets painted about Moshe, because the psukim, they sound great. He's wonderful. He's a tzaddik. He's tamim. He's great. He's the only hero in his generation. But we're all familiar with Rashi's statement at the beginning of the parsha that, well, maybe it's not so good. Maybe tzaddik b'dorosov. He was a tzaddik in his generation, that's only by comparison, because it was a pretty lousy generation. But in a generation like Avraham Avinu, he would not have stood out at all. Maybe he wouldn't even have been anything. And others read it l'shvach that no, that even in that generation, he was able to stand up and be counted by himself. That's a tremendous thing. So we have this range of approaches, and it seems surprising that you have the Gnai approach, but it seems like if you just read the psukim, he sounds great. And yet, there's a voice in Chazal that finds a negative to every positive. So the Dorosov, he was only relatively good. Matzochein, yeah, he somehow got God's favor, but that means he didn't deserve it. He didn't actually earn his survival. It's just because Matzochein. And some of it comes from this Aliyah, just to skip ahead for a moment before we start the Aliyah, but there is a pasuk here that Chazal comments on, and also it seems a little bit surprising that the pasuk says that here is pasuk Zion, v'yavo they went into the teva mipnei me'amabul. Because of the rain, because of the impending flood. So Rashi here quotes this idea, Af Noach miktani amuna haya. So even Noach was not so great when it comes to amuna. He was deficient in amuna. The language of the Medrash that Rashi is based on actually has, I think, a harsher language, mechusari amuna. He was absent of amuna. Why? He was maimin ve'eino maimin. So he didn't really believe fully Shiyavu HaMabul that the flood was going to come. Lo nichnas l'teva ad shidachuku hamayim. He didn't go in until the water actually forced him to. So some say, some of the Sfarim say that, oh, why is this voice in Chazal that he was only good b'darosav? Well, because it's consistent with this comment that he was not a complete believer. But even that seems overly harsh. And here, he did spend 120 years building a teva. You would think that that's a pretty good expression of belief. And to be labeled a non-believer just because he waited until it actually started raining before going in, it seems to also reflect a pretty negative attitude towards Noah, which seems ungenerous. It seems ungracious. So what exactly is this attitude about? There is one clue in Torah Shebichtav that there was somewhat of a mixed feeling about Noach, and that's in the Haftorah. The Haftorah for Parshas Noach, which parts of it are Haftorah, so other times of the year also, is from the Nevi Yeshaya. So it refers to the flood. And the way it refers to the flood, it's a little bit of a question how to read the pasuk, but it seems that this is indeed the case. It refers to the flood as May Noah, as the waters of Noah. And there are those who note that you would expect that it should be called the opposite. The flood should be called the waters of everybody but Noah. That Noah was the one person who, and his family, who survived the flood. So why is the flood named after him? It should be named after everyone else. Now, you might say, okay, that's not such a kasha, because it means the time of Noah, the fact that Noah was the survivor, is itself what connects him to the story, so we understand why it's referred that way. You know, we have a scenario nowadays where a doctor finds a disease, so he gets the big tchus that the disease is named after him, even though he's the healer, as if he created the disease. So, you know, it's not such an unprecedented, well, this would be precedenting it, but it's not such an uncommon idea. Now, there's a whole debate about whether a pandemic should be named after places where they come from or places where they're associated with. So sometimes it suggests blame and sometimes it doesn't, but there are those who point to that pasuk and they say that, right, and they say that this indicates that Noah somehow was responsible for the flood. And that reflects the idea that Noah was somehow lacking in having an impact on others. And there are different formulations of just how that plays out. Either that he didn't try very much to influence the people around him, or that maybe he tried. Again, he stood there and built a teva for 120 years under great mockery. So it seems like he was trying to make a statement and to stand up and let people see what was happening. And there is that perspective as well. But some phrase there, lo haya b'kocho, we find in some of the sources that he just didn't have the investment, perhaps, in people that would have allowed him to have an impact on where they could have listened to him and where it could have made a difference. Maybe that's what it means. There are those who draw the contrast that if we look through history, if we look from Noah to Avram to Moshe, so we see that there's a big difference along a spectrum here. That Noah is told that he's going to be saved, everyone's going to be destroyed, and he's going to be saved, and apparently, okay, fine, tell me what to do, how do I get saved? Doesn't sound like he's that interested in saving everyone else, whether the issue is that he didn't try to influence them or the issue is that he didn't pray for them. One way or another, it doesn't sound like he's so involved in the needs of saving these people. While we get to Avraham Avinu in 2 weeks from now, and Avraham is told that Sodom is going to be destroyed, and he doesn't say, okay, so fine, but he davens on behalf, and he argues on behalf of Sodom. He tries to save them. So it's not enough for him that he and his family will be saved. He still wants to try to help those who are destined for destruction. So that seems to be a higher madrega than Noah. And then you get to Moshe Rabbeinu, which is the highest madrega, when Moshe is told that the Jews are looking at being wiped out because of the Chet HaEgel. So not only does he not just say fine, and even God explicitly tells him, I'm going to make you a big nation, and you're going to be fine, you're going to be great, but Moshe is not okay with that. But not only is he not okay with that, but he davens on their behalf. And not only does he daven on their behalf, he says that if you're not going to listen to what I'm saying, then take me out also. That's the highest madrega of involving yourself with the needs of those who are threatened. And Moshe Rabbeinu represents what seems to be a very different attitude than Noah. And in fact, it was the Arizal who noted that Moshe is metaking this flaw in Noah, and that therefore the letters of Mei Noach, which seem to indict Noach, can be rearranged to spell Mecheni. No, Mecheni, that idea that Moshe said, erase me, is representative of the opposite attitude of Noah. So what exactly is going on when Noah gets such a bad rap, and what exactly is the issue here? So perhaps you could suggest a little bit that the idea of Noah as a character, so we also find that Chazal has a perspective on Noah that his name correlates to, that the word Noah means calm. And a person who is Noah is a person who doesn't get very angry, which on the surface is a very good thing, because anger is dangerous, and anger is harmful, and it's one of the midos that the Rambam says that not only is it very possibly an actual avera to lose your temper, but it's a midos defect that is distinct from all other midos issues, kamat, with maybe the exception of gaiva. The Rambam writes that normally when it comes to midos, we're supposed to try to aim for the middle path, for the darach ha-mu'atza. But when it comes to path, we should stay away from completely. So it seems to be a good thing that Noach was not given to caste. But there's a drawback also, that when somebody doesn't get angry, so it could be okay, he's calm and in control. But the flip side of that, the negative view of that, is it could just be he's just apathetic. He just doesn't feel moved. He doesn't have the passion to care. You know, the Gemara says in the beginning of Tainus, that when you have a Talmud Chacham who gets angry, it's the Torah that makes him angry. And then the Gemara says, but even so, he should still calm down. He should still be in control. But the instinct to get angry comes from the Torah. So what does that mean? So it seems to me that Rashi says that he has a Harchavas Hadas that comes from his learning. He has a broader perspective, and apparently what he's getting at is that if you don't notice anything, so you're not going to get angry about anything. But if you're paying attention to a lot of what's there, you see what's happening, and you care, and you're invested, so then that has the potential to get you angry. And perhaps that's the flip side of Noah's Mila, that on the one hand, okay, he was a calm person, but it also reflects a lack of drive and of passion and of investment that should have gotten him concerned about others. And perhaps that's reflected in the Limud from this Aliyah, the idea of he was Miktani Amuna, that he was deficient in faith. So it's interesting, what exactly does that mean? He was looking in faith. So a little bit Al Pidarach Hadrush doesn't really fit the Limud 100%, but Kedushas Levi, or Levi Yitzchok, or Beditra have understood that he didn't have faith in himself. He didn't have faith in himself that he could make a difference. And a pashtus here is, it's not about faith in himself, it's about faith in what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling him was going to happen. And the truth is, the balance of these two kinds of emunah is probably relevant to the whole question of when and how anger is proper and when it's improper. Because the proper balance for anger would seem to be having the right weighting of faith in oneself and faith in God. Because if one doesn't have faith in oneself, doesn't think he can make a difference, so then he's never going to be moved to do anything. So he's just going to be apathetic, or he's not going to take any initiative because he doesn't believe that he's capable. So you need to have faith in yourself in order to act. But the extreme of that is if you think it's all up to you, that you're in control of the world, so that creates a great sense of frustration because you can't actually control everything. God is still running the world. And it's an aspect of lo alecha ha'mlacha ligmor v'lo atah ben chayrin hibatol mimena, that you're not able to actually manage the whole situation, but you're still not able to neglect it either, that we have to do what we can and believe that we can make a difference, and ultimately recognize that the Kaddish Baruch Hu runs the world. And perhaps that's why when the Gemara talks about caste and how terrible it is, the Gemara says that Gemara Masech Shabbos says Kol HaShover Kelim B'Chamato, if somebody destroys utensils from his rage, from his losing of his temper, so it's as if he engaged in idolatry. So why is that compared to what it is? That's expensive, dangerous habits to break Kelim in your rage, but why is that idolatrous? So some understand because the whole essence of idolatry is that you give over control of yourself to another force, so giving over to anger is also a kind of avodah zarah. But perhaps we could say here also that if somebody just believes everything is hopeless and all he can do is throw plates against the wall because there is no dayan in the world, there is no guiding force, so then that's a kind of avodah zarah. So you need to have the balance between faith in yourself and faith in God, faith in yourself that you can make a difference, and faith in God that it's not your job to make all the difference, but that there is a guiding force and a creator in the world that's running things, and he asks you to do your part, and not to shirk from it, to say you have no faith in yourself, and not to give up in exasperation and say there is no God, but to find that proper balance and that expression of a motivating passion that doesn't give itself to a temper. It's interesting to say for all Moshe, I believe, he points out that the idea of not having faith in yourself, if you understand it like that, or not having faith yourself, yourself not having adequate faith, is that if you're looking to be mashpia on others, if you're looking to make a difference on the people around you, so then the faith has to be overflowing. It has to not only be present, it has to be present in a visible and abundant enough fashion that it's going to impact others. So the idea that Noah wasn't able to make a difference on people, that also could connect to this notion that somehow his faith was incomplete, and even though we don't want to deprive him of the credit that he deserves for following these instructions and spending 120 years building a teva, that's more than twice as long as the average contractor takes to finish a house, so it's a big deal, so we should give him credit for that, but it's still on some level lacking. So that's, you know, together it could be a hakdama to the whole parsha, but it's also a hakdama to our second aliyah here, because that pasuk that is understood by Chazal and Rashi to mean there was something lacking in his faith is one of the pasukim that we will come across in the next few minutes. But also we find his tzidkus invoked in a different way than it is in the beginning of the parsha, in the first pasuk in this aliyah. So let's just actually begin looking at the words. So the beginning of Parak Zion, which is the beginning of the second aliyah, says the Yom Hashem Noach, Bo atah v'chol beischa el hateva. You should all go to the teva. So first of all, what about the, not just how Noach is described, but how is God described? So the Yom Hashem. Before this, he was Elohim. Elohim is Midas Hadin, and Hashem is Midas Harachamim. So many Mefarshim understand that the shift is now to Midas Harachamim, because now we're talking about who's going to get saved. Before, we were talking about who's going to get destroyed. So all of that's an expression of Din. Now we're talking about Rachmanis, so it shifts to Hashem. The Ramban sees this as connected to the idea of the Karbanos that Noach is going to bring, and the Schus of the Karbanos is going to evoke Rachamim. So, therefore, to use the Amir Tarachamim name here is also appropriate. And Itziv has an interesting suggestion that the idea is that there's Rachmanis here on Noach beyond the Din. So, if Alpi Din, he was meant to be saved, itself a discussion, but let's assume that for a second, is the fact that he's being saved, so that is straight justice. But there's also Rachamim in that he was able to bring onto the Teva not just animals for the repopulation of the world, but also animals and avadim to serve him, to take care of his needs. And therefore, there is midas harachamim in that sense as well, which is also a very fascinating idea. It paints kind of a whole picture. It's a little different than we're used to. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his day for Emes LeYaakov, Rabbi Yaakov understands that Noach was already makdish the animals in advance, the ones that he would be bringing as korbanos, and that was to invoke rachamim. He thought that he could maybe stop things. And he suggests that maybe that's the pshat of the pasuk that comes later that we were referring to before, the idea that he was the katne amun, or that he was somewhere in between. So, yes, he believed in God, but he also believed that ultimately it wouldn't be so bad, that ultimately he would be able to turn things around. And maybe that's why he ended up waiting, because he thought that he could bring about Rachmanus. The idea that he's referred to here as a tzaddik, and not a tzaddik tamim this time, so at the beginning of the parashah he's referred to as a tzaddik tamim. So Rashi writes, Mikan she'omer miktusracha shal adam b'fanav, v'kulo shal adam b'fanav. So you see that in the beginning of the parashah, where Noach is not being addressed, so he's referred to as a perfect tzaddik. But here, where God's talking to Noach, he's just called a tzaddik. So maybe the reason is because when you're talking to someone, so we don't want to praise them completely, and we have this notion of mixus racha b'fanav v'kulo shuva b'fanav, that when speaking to somebody directly, we only say a part of what we could be saying about how great they are. So the idea that mixus racha b'fanav, the Sfarim explain, that it's because of Chanifa. We don't want to look like Chanifa, like we're trying to butter somebody up in a extreme fashion. So if you're going to say everything good you could possibly say about somebody, maybe the person deserves it. Maybe that's not actually Chanifa, but it looks like Chanifa. It's something that maybe doesn't have a great appearance. So the Torah Tzimim notes that okay, but here we're talking about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yilchar doesn't have to worry about the Chanifa. So it explains that this is in the whole vein of modeling Midos. The Kadosh Baruch Hu teaches us how to behave, even if it's not really relevant to him directly. So he's teaching us this Midah of Mitzvah Shachar B'fana. The Znayim LaTorah, let's say from holding here, the Lutzke Rav, so he explains that is actually the whole flow of the pasuk is all connected here. That when it says, first of all, that he's telling him to go into the teva, which he was already told before, and some of the mafreshim also discuss why does that have to be repeated here and what's going on when he says ki yotzar isi tzadik lofanai. So the Znayim LaTorah explains that there was the hope here, or there was the potential for the world to do tshuva. So this whole 120 year period, the idea was that the people should see what's happening and they should be inspired to do tshuva. So if that's the idea, so then maybe that happened. So Noah doesn't have an update. The people who did tshuva are not necessarily going to come to him and tell him. So at this point, now that it's actually game time, so he doesn't know what exactly is happening. He doesn't know if other people are going to come onto the teva or if the flood's been called off. He doesn't know where things stand as far as the tshuva. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says to him, go to the teva now, you by yourself. I've seen that you're still the only tzaddik, you and your family. A little bit of discussion, the farshim, where his family sits in. Would the family also tzaddikim? Or maybe the family was also not so great, but just because it would have been an onish to Noah to not bring his family with. So maybe Noah was the only tzaddik, and the family also wasn't terrific. So this language, singling him out, you're the tzaddik here, so maybe it means him even within his family. Or if it includes his family, so fine. But still, no one else got on board, figuratively and literally. Nobody else got on board with the whole tshuva plan. And so no one else is getting on board to the teva because they didn't respond. It didn't make a difference. So you should know now that that's the instruction. Okay, so what does he do? So he's told, Mikol ha-behema ha-tahora tikach lucha shiva. Shiva, so you should take seven of each of the pure animals, each of each those, seven each pair, so 14. And when a behema shalot tahara, he shnayim ish ishto, and a pair of all the non-kosher animals. So, first of all, the language where it says tikach, specifically by the first part of the pasuk, by the kosher animal, the back of Kamenetsky has a comment here that it was actually harder to get the kosher animals to come on board. The Tameim came on their own. He says that based on the language of the Ramban. And he explains that since the kosher animals are going to be used for the karbanos, so therefore you have to work harder. It requires more hishtadlos in order to perform the mitzvah. But, okay, so he brings kosher animals. So how come he didn't say kosher? Well, what does kosher mean? Can I call the OU? Is there a website? How do I find out what kosher animals are? He didn't know any Jewish people, right? So how's he going to understand what's kosher and what's not? So Rashi says over here, you see that Noah learned Torah. So that's a concept that always requires a little bit of consideration, what it means when we talk about people in Chumash learning Torah who are not only before Matan Torah, which itself creates a certain challenge, but before there's any stirrings of Judaism, before you have Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So what does it mean to say they learn Torah? And what about the fact that the Torah is supposed to be exclusively for Jews, and therefore maybe it's not even proper for others to be learning Torah, as the Gemara indicates? So here, it seems like the whole imperative to say that he learned Torah because he was able to figure out who is kosher and who isn't, what animal is kosher and what animal isn't. So it's interesting, the Gemara at the end of Zvachim actually seems to say the opposite. The Gemara says that he was able to tell because the animals were near the Teva, and the Teva kind of clued him in that the Teva only absorbed the right number of animals depending on what category it was in. So it's not necessarily clear that he knew which was which, but that it was able to play out that way, and he got help. He had this study guide here. He had this cheat sheet from the Teva. So if that's the case, maybe he didn't learn Torah. So there's a long essay about this in a contemporary sefer called the Beis Hillel. It goes through some of the questions about this point, and he suggests that the point wasn't just that Noach knew who goes, but that he understood that there's a nafkamina, that this the tahora ones are going to be edible by Jews at some point, and the non-tahora ones not. And what's appropriate for Karbanos, the fact that he understood the significance, shows that he learned Torah. But even that, you could say, that he was able to figure out there was a significance, because clearly God had some kind of chayin, some kind of specific interest in these animals more than the others, kaviyachal, whatever we mean by that. But he clearly had some kind of expressed preference for these animals over the others. So the truth is, and you could say that that's what Talmud Torah means, the whole idea that Talmud Torah before the Torah was given presumably had to mean a careful contemplation of nature and creation and trying to figure out what God's message is through that. So the idea that he would look at what the Teva was doing and see that God is sending him a message and try to understand what that message could mean, presumably all of that is the definition of Talmud Torah for a figure of that era and for someone in his position. So presumably that's really what it's all getting at. And the idea that the Torah is specifically for the Jews, so that would presumably be after the Torah was given to the Jews in its full form. So then it's a gezel and it's inappropriate to insert yourself into that relationship. But before the Torah is given to the Jews, so to learn Torah in this sense, I would imagine it's probably not subject to this whole prohibition. Okay, but in any event, so he was able to know what was Tahora and what was not Tahora. So here's a moment of synergy, and we'll take some review from it also, that you may recall that what is this a reference to where is this discussed, this pasuk, right? And the references here of a similar nature, where do they come up? Sachem Dav Gimel, right? So where we saw at the beginning of the year, that the Gemara in our Masechta that we saw, we spent some time on, comments on this phrasing, that the Torah is using extra letters, apparently unnecessarily. And instead of saying Tameya, it's saying Asher Lo Tahoru. So our Gemara quoted this as saying that a person should always train himself to speak carefully, and he shouldn't say Adavar Maguna. He shouldn't talk in a vulgar, crass fashion. And we spoke, so it's worth reviewing, it's a very important concept. We spoke about the idea of Nivul Peh, and how it's something which is crucially important for our behavior today and gets more important every day because as society gets lower and lower as far as that's concerned, as far as vulgarity and profanity is concerned, it becomes increasingly important that B'nai Torah of the world, the religious people overall, be even more careful to speak in a refined fashion and to not let themselves descend to that kind of language, which, in addition to the fact that there are prohibitions involved, but the perception of the world, despite the fact that profanity has become so widespread to absurd and appalling degrees in people's vocabulary, but it's still something that can be perceived as a drawing line between refined personalities and not refined personalities. So therefore, if one wants to make a Kiddush Hashem, I hope everyone does, so then to appreciate how important it is to speak carefully, which will be recognized by those around you. They'll understand that somebody who is refined doesn't use that kind of language. This is a crucial, crucial venue for Kiddush Hashem. Like we said when we saw the Gemara in Masechet Pesachim and the discussion around that. And this is true because the Kiddush Hashem and Chil Hashem, because it is perceived by the world as a factor, even if there's this tremendous degradation of what people actually do, but it's still understood that there is a distinction here as far as character is concerned. And it could be that the prohibition of Nivul Peh is applicable to non-Jews as well. This is the parsha of the mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, of the mitzvahs that apply to all of humanity. So the Kadosh Baruch Hu Rav, we mentioned at the time, has a tshuva where he talks about how do we understand the nature of the Isser of Nivul Peh if it's understood as a abizrayu de Gili Arayis, so something in the overall rubric of Gili Arayis, because the pasuk of that the pasuk of Ervas Dover can be understood to read Ervas Dibor. Often the Torah, when it uses the word Dover, Chazal understand it to reflect speech and Dibor, so Ervas Dover can be Ervas Dibor. So if it's within the rubric of Gili Arayis on some level, so then it should be perhaps included in the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. Rabbeinu Yonah has a different understanding. Rabbeinu Yonah understands it as part of the overall idea of Lashon Hara, and then maybe it would have different parameters. But either way, when we talk about Davar Maguna, at least as far as we're concerned, so here it means both. It means not to speak in a vulgar fashion and not to speak in a unnecessarily negative fashion. So the Torah, which is making a point here, because as Meforshim point out, in other contexts, we talk about actual mitzvot of kashrus, so the Torah doesn't hesitate just to say it's straight, just to say it's tmeya. But here, there is, like the Baal Mor points out, when it's a mitzvah, so it's an azhara, so the Torah has it directly. But here, where there's an opportunity to model greater care, just for the sake of the message, so this helps us to appreciate how important it is to avoid both vulgarity and negativity that is not warranted. As an acquaintance of mine, Sefer Ma'ariv Yitzchak, has a little discussion about this, that the issue is, even if it's not actual vulgarity, some of these examples that the Gemara has, And certainly the word Tmeya is not something that we would assume is profane. It's just the idea that we should phrase it in a more positive kind of way. Why is that so important? So it's a part of the fact that you need to control your nature here, and that you want to control your habits and keep yourself very far away, not only from a crass and vulgar mindset, but also from an overly negative mindset. And that impacts on how you relate to everything. And you may not be aware, but I know you guys are huge masmidims, so you probably didn't know this, but there's actually an election coming up in America. It's a presidential election coming up very soon. And unfortunately, I'm not saying anything about either side here, but there's certainly a lot of negativity that is flying in both directions. And it's always been a chaval, and here it's ramped up to a reasonable degree, but it's always been a chaval that politics everywhere, and politics in America also, especially at presidential levels, have to focus so much on negative campaigning. It's not just a question of Lashon Hara, without getting into the issue of where Lashon Hara fits in a presidential campaign, but the issue of having a negative orientation towards things. And we'd like to believe that when you've narrowed it down, you have 350 million people in the country, and you've narrowed it down to the top two who are running to be president, that there'd be a better argument you could make than the other guy's a disaster. Hopefully there is something that you can say positively, and the focus on the negative, setting aside whether it's justified or not, which is always a huge issue. It shouldn't be set aside, but even so, the impact of the negativity is very, very powerful. And it degrades our character and our aspirations. And they did a study in the 2004 election, when George W. Bush was running against John Kerry, and there was a professor at UCLA named Iacobini who did a test using neural imaging, and he had supporters of either candidate, and he scanned their brains and saw that when they talked about their favorite candidate, so they had positive emotions. And that was in an early stage in the campaign. And then, after a few months, when there was so much slung back and forth, that they did another test of these same people, and they saw they just had negative emotions about everybody. It just had a very powerful impact on how they viewed even the candidate that they supported. And that's a chaval, that if we look to somebody to lift us up, and the best we can do is just, well, this one's more terrible than the other, whether the facts justify that or not, but just the reality that that should be the way things need to be portrayed, if that's really what we're saying here, it has a very serious negative impact, and we should hope someday that that's not how we'll be talking, and that it's not, and we should try to both have the circumstances deserve and our characters tend towards a positive way of expressing ourselves and of looking at our options. Okay, so to continue, we probably have to go a little bit, but just to move on. Okay, so Pasta continues, Gami Ofa Shemayim Shiva Shiva Zachani Kevlios, Lachayos Sai Lachayos Zara Pnekal Aret, Kliyam Od Shiva Nilfi Mansir Ala Aret, Abba Emil, Abba Laila, Lachisius Kolia Kuma Sheretis Melpin Adma, the Asnach Sheretivos, the Noach did everything God said, get in there, I'm going to wake everybody out. The Noach Ben Shesh Mel Shana, the Hamabul Hayamayim Ala Aret. So here it's starting to rain, and Noach is 600 years old. So the idea of highlighting his age here, so Chazal, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, note that the people used to call him old, that the people would make fun of him. And the Zayim Latara has a comment here about that also, that it's not just that they were saying that he is of older years, but that they were saying that, you know, get with the times. What is this? That you're building a big boat because God told you to, and you're not coming out with us and partying and doing all the activities that we're involved in. You're an old fogey. Get with the times. You're old fashioned. You don't realize that that's not what people do anymore. That's not the way to be. And that's how they looked at him. And you know, we see ultimately who wins. We see ultimately who was right here. But this whole way of talking, we're very familiar with. It's a common attitude towards people who are resisting that which may not be positive development. And this bias towards anything that's new and anything that is youthful is often a very misleading force. So that's what we see here as well. And the idea that Torah connects here the notion of the flood, Meha Mabul, so the Yerushalmi in Erevin says that for an Eruv, for an Eruv Chumin, you shouldn't use water or salt because they're min klala. And water and salt, the Mefarshim, the Karban Eza writes in the Shira Karban, that because salt is used with stone, and the water is used with a marble, or used as a klala. And Yosef Engel, in his Gilyone Ashas to the Yerushalmi Brachos, so he notes that the Halacha of Mishnah Chala says that when you take challah from a loaf, you do so after putting the water in. So he writes that that's because you want to, of course, the pasuk in Yecheskel to this effect, that you want to put bracha on top of the challah. So that's the idea. Okay, so fine. So here now we have this controversial pasuk, this pasuk that seems to put Noach in a bad light, but you have a Noach of one of Ishna and Neshevon of, Yitol al Atevus Ne Meha Mabul. So just to add one more interpretation to what we saw before about the idea of it being Mekatne Yamuna, so in a more Alpidara Chajrush sense, the Oiv Yisrael, who was also a very positively oriented, gracious-spirited Chassidish Rebbe, Yisrael of Apt, the Aptarav, Rav Mishu Heshel of Apt, excuse me, the Aptarav. So he's quoted in the Paradis Yosef saying that Amunah sometimes means belief, but sometimes it also means to raise, to bring about someone's growth, like we see in the Pasuk in Megillas Esther, that Mordechai was Omein as Hadassah. So that idea of Amunah, so he suggests in a more positive light that Noah didn't want to see this destruction happen. And if he would stall getting onto the Teva, so then that would allow some more space. So he didn't want to rush onto the Teva and be bringing about, be Omein, this situation. So therefore he's Mekatne Yamuna in that sense. Okay. So more positive view towards it. All right. So Min HaBehema HaTahora, Min HaBehema Asher Inan HaTahora, it could be this pasuk is also the source of the whole discussion. What pasuk is actually quoted in Chazal as the source of Shurinan et Tahara? That's also a discussion. Shnayim Shnayim Bol Al Noach Al Ateva Zachar Nekeva Kasher Tziva Lekimus Noach. Okay. Vayhi L'Shiva Tayam Mumeham Abul Hayu Al Aret. So then there was another week. It was another week, and Meha Mabul were present. So Meha Mabul came. So why was there another week? Why is there a week delay? So the Gemara, Mesachas Sanhedrin, and Daf Kuf Hei, the Gemara has and other places in Chazal also, but a bunch of them are there. And the Gemara and Sanhedrin have a number of different interpretations as to what this week was there to accomplish. So, for example, the Gemara has one view that they were given a week of Me'ein Olam Haba, that before the destruction, they were able to get a taste of what they were giving up, what Olam Haba was, what it meant to be worthy of reward, so they could fully understand what they were trading. And that was also a part of the punitive process. The Yerushalmi in Moed Katan understands that it was 7 days of Shiva, that God said Shiva can be Yochel for the world. So normally Shiva is after Nisa. So here is Shiva before. So Svarim explained that human beings who don't know what's going to happen, so they have to wait until Rahman son is bad news, and then they wait Shiva after. But God, who knows what the plans are, so if he's going to Kiviyachal to Shiva, he can do so in advance, and that's what the idea is he's modeling. And some quote this as a remez to the idea of Shiva Menetaru. We assume la halacha that Avela Shiva is Drabbanan, but the Yerushalmi has this idea that there's kind of a remez to its Menetaru, so that could perhaps be the source for it. But there's also an idea that you find that the Gemara mentions that this was Shiva specifically for Mesushalach. So the oldest man in history lived to be 969. So he just died then, according to this perspective. And he was a tzaddik. So he was going to die before this because either way, then he'd have to be on a mabul or he'd have to be killed with a flood, and that wasn't appropriate. So the flood waits until after he dies. And that includes another week for Shiva. So Chazal also emphasized, you see how important the idea of Hesped is, that that's not only for Mr. Shalach's sake, but also for the rest of the world that should hear his Hespedim, that should hear him eulogized. Even though Tar Tamima points out, presumably there wasn't much Hesped going on because the rest of the world were not appreciative of this, because the rest of the world were made up of people with a very different mindset. So it's hard to imagine how much of a Hesped he was getting, but certainly he deserved the Hesped. And we know that Chazal put a very great emphasis on the importance of appropriate Hesped. So there was a delay, at least to theoretically accommodate that. So here the Aznayim Matara has a comment. It says, Kadosh Baruch Hu knows what's going to happen. He's planning out the whole world. So he knew when Tushalach was going to die. So why wasn't the Teva scheduled? Why wasn't the Fledger scheduled a week later? Why was it scheduled then? And then you have an extra week. We'll wait for the Shiva of Mr. Shalach. So he explains that basically we've seen that the 120 years that Noach was working on the Teva was supposed to be a time for tshuva, a time for people to catch on to what was happening and to do better. So this was also an opportunity for tshuva, that this was also when they would hear the Hespedim, theoretically, assuming that was the third community, that there actually were active Hespedim when people were reacting to the death of a tzaddik, so maybe that would inspire some people to turn around. So this is another slot of tshuva, and he says, Yidavka need to have two slots, a big slot and a short slot. So you have a 120-year period, and then you have the one-week period. You have the long period to do tshuva, and the short period. Why do you need two? Because that's human psychology, he writes, that people just get used to a situation. So even though there's been this long, long tkufa where they could have woken up and they could have realized what they have to change, but ultimately people just get used to it and it doesn't get through. It doesn't have any impact. So then it needs to shift gears. So in that last week, there's another tkufa of tshuva. Okay, here, now we're really about to go through with it, and now you're hearing the Hespedim for the Tzaddik. Now is really the time, okay, here's your last shot. You should get up, and you should do tshuva. Okay, so an interesting perspective. The Ohel Moshe points out that, a quote from Bishal Salanter, this whole idea of waiting for the Shiva of Mitzushalach, so that's also a part of the idea the Pasuk says in Hazinu, that Hatzur Tamim Palo, that God's actions are perfect, and that means in terms of justice, that if you have a human court system, which is actually a mitzvah, we mitzvahs may know us, we have to have a court system, so we have to enforce punishment, and we have to regulate society, and we can't really accommodate everything, so if an individual has to be punished, or if an individual sort of has to be executed, so then the family is going to suffer, and the family is going to pay a price, even though they didn't commit the crime. But human beings, they can't control for all of that. They just have to deal with what's in front of them. But Hatzor, Tamim Palo, God is able to take care of every single detail of everything. So not only was Mr. Shalach worthy of avoiding the flood and the destruction, but even his Shiva shouldn't be cut off. That should also be able to be accommodated. Okay, so just to, almost out of time, just to say one or two more points here. We'll skip a little bit. Let's get towards the end. So, Pasuk Gimel, Ve'etzim Yom Hazeh Ba'Noach, V'Shem V'Chom V'Yefes Ne'Noach, V'Eishas Noach Shlosh Ne'Sheivana V'Tam L'Teva. This is the middle of the day. Sounds like it was noontime. And as Rashi explains, that this was to also make a point that here they were mocking him and they were saying, where the people around him were saying, we're not going to let you do this. We're not going to, support this plan. So you might think, okay, he's going to have to sneak out in the middle of the night and take off. But no, in order to make the point that this is God's plan. And even all of their efforts to try to mock him and try to undermine it are not going to happen. So just mention one final point here. When Pasuk Yudalit, it says, Hey, lo, v'chol achayi l'mina, v'chol behema l'mina, v'chol haremet, haromet, ala aretz minayi, v'chol ha'of l'minayi, kol tzipor, kol kanaf. All of the animals are all together in one big boat. So the Paris Yosef has a comment here. Paris Yosef, I think I've mentioned in the past, Paris Yosef is a beautiful sefer on Chumash, which was written a long time ago by Rezef Patanovsky, and he only has up to Vayikra, Bereishis, Shmos, and Vayikra. And there's a contemporary Mechaber of David Mandelbaum, who's an unbelievably prolific Mechaber. He's just a machine in terms of he just produces and produces and produces. So he published the Paris Yosef on Bamidbar and Dvarim, in the style of the original Paris Yosef. So it basically became a franchise now. So it's Paris Yosef on those volumes of Chumash and on the Haggadah and on the Rosh Hashanah and on all kinds of volumes now with Paris Yosef based on the style that was initiated by the original Paris Yosef. So the original Paris Yosef that we have, you can certainly find it online, and it's also been republished in greater detail as part of the new set together with these volumes, but very kedai to look at the Paris Yosef in general. He has this tremendously eclectic style where he just quotes from all kinds of svarim. He talks about halach, and he talks about Musar, and he talks about drush and chassidus and stories. Just has this very sweeping, eclectic approach to Torah and brings it all down. And he discusses there, here he has a little bit of a wistful, perhaps, Shmuz, where he says, so if we have all the animals getting together on the Teva, so what's the big deal about Yemos HaMashiach? Right? So we are looking forward to a time when the wolf and the lamb can lie down together and not kill each other, and we think that that's going to be so amazing. But it happened already. Apparently we're able to get all of these prey and predators together on the Teva, and they survived there, so what's the big deal? So he suggests, as you've often heard people lament, that when there's a crisis, we're able to get together. When there's some kind of big threat, so then those who are adversarial towards each other are able to come together and face the threat as one, and then you can have that kind of achdus. You can have people coexist. But the godless of Mashiach, the Yimei HaMashiach, is that even without some kind of threat, we'll be able to coexist, and it's not going to be artificially imposed in what's really more of an alliance. When you have two people who would otherwise be enemies, but they work together to fight a common threat, that's called an alliance. They're not really friends. They're not really b'achdus with each other. But Yimei HaMashiach, we should have actual achdus. So that lament that it takes a crisis to bring us together, unfortunately, I would almost say that we're even worse than that, that now I don't even know if the crisis brings us together, that even when there is a great challenge that should lead to everyone just getting on the same page, it doesn't seem like that's the reaction. And we've seen these past few months how much in all aspects of society, so we're undergoing for the first time in our lives a crisis that has actually affected the entire planet at once, and the entire world is dealing with this whole issue of the pandemic. And yeah, we're still finding a lot to fight about within that, and a lot to attack each other about. So I think it seems like we're two steps removed. I hope I'm wrong. Mashiach should come tomorrow. But it seems like we're two steps removed as far as that's concerned. It's not that it takes a crisis to get it together, but even the crisis doesn't really do it. So it means we really need Mashiach faster. It means that we need to skip over the crisis and to just get to the stage where we're able to have true achdus for its own reasons, not that it's forced by any need for alliances or to focus on bigger problems, but for positive reasons. And that should be our bracha, and that should be the hope of the post-Diluvian age, just as the Mabul was over, we were able to look towards a more hopeful new world, so too this pandemic should also soon be over, and we should be able to look to a more hopeful environment. I wish all of us to be inspired with that bracha as we learn Parshas Noach. I wish you all a wonderful and uplifting and safe and healthy Shabbos. And I look forward to seeing you on Sunday when we've got a lot to do to wrap up the sugyas and Dalet Amud Beis that we mentioned. We'll try to do a little more of the Shas sugyas that connect to that also. So we got a full Sunday ahead of us. But I wish you a wonderful Shabbos. It should be only good things. We should be able to speak with a perspective that doesn't require us to invoke anything negative or anything low, but only speak in positive and uplifting ways, and it should have ripple effects to all of us. Have a great Shabbos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great Shabbos.